And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name's Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of July 22nd, 2019. My name's Ted McIntyre. I just said that, didn't I? I was thinking it's because July 23rd is my brother's birthday. So happy birthday to my brother on July 23rd, the day after this podcast comes out. I'm still Ted McIntyre, and we are still being joined by our co-host, the illustrious author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Ted?
It's a real question. At this point, I'm kind of struggling. What am I doing here? Anyway, one of the things that I thought it was useful to talk about this week is the Vineyard Wind Project, just to bring people up to speed. Many people who have been following the climate fight here in New England and indeed nationwide remember a project called Cape Wind, which was a wind project that was to be built off of Cape Cod in Nantucket Sound, which is now, if you're familiar with the map, between Cape Cod and Nantucket. So Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard are two islands off Cape Cod. I mean, this Cape Wind project was going to go between them. That went on for years and years. The Koch brothers bitterly fought it. Cape Wind finally died a few years ago. A sad testament to a lot of things. But anyway, there's a second project called Vineyard Wind. Now, Vineyard Wind is distinguished by being also a large-scale wind project backed more enthusiastically by the government of Massachusetts. Vineyard Wind is well offshore. It's 14 miles offshore, so I don't think you can even see the wind turbines.
And that was a problem with Cape Wind, right?
That was a problem with Cape Wind where, well, you could barely see the Cape Wind ones. It was a lot of NIMBY stuff. But there's something like 800 megawatts of power that would be generated by the Vineyard Wind project 14 miles south of Martha's Vineyard. And that's all good. It's been marching along, has tried, I think that project, the Vineyard Wind Project, has been much more effective in trying to get buy-in from all of the participants, the people who might object, and to do everything correctly. It seemed things were on a good route. This past week, there are two things of note that have happened. The first is that the Conservation Commission in a town called Edgartown. So Edgartown is this gorgeous little... have you ever been to Martha's Vineyard, Mariah?
I have.
You have.
I run a 20-mile race there.
Well, there you go. You know it better than I do. So Edgartown is this beautiful little town on Martha's Vineyard. Has a Conservation Commission. They rejected an application from Vineyard Wind to put a buried cable something like 1 mile off the shore of Edgartown as it marched. That cable, I think, marches into the mainland. That's not such a good thing. It's not clear why the Conservation Commission rejected that application.
There's something, too, with fishermen, right, that the fishermen were expressing concern about how the project would affect their business and that they may have been putting some pressure.
Maybe, perhaps. There was not a lot of reporting on why the whole thing got, that particular application got rejected. I think the Conservation Commission there is open to more information. It's considered something of a setback, but not a major setback, but certainly a setback for Vineyard Wind, which had been marching along pretty well. I think the other, or maybe, Mariah, you tell me, what's the federal problem that Vineyard Wind has bumped into, and what are the implications of that?
The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management was supposed to put out an environmental impact statement, right, and it sounds like that's being delayed to come from the federal government.
And for no particularly good reason, from what I've seen.
Yeah, and it's just going to be delayed indefinitely, so it's not clear when it's going to go through.
I mean, that's not a... That's not a good sign, especially given the current occupant of the White House's spastic opposition to anything reasonable like a wind project off of Martha's Vineyard, that the Federal Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, which is a relatively new organization, mostly I think under the Obama administration, to try and manage these offshore resources, they've gone radio silent, right? No, don't expect anything from us anytime soon. That's more of an issue. Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple nuances here that I think are interesting. And the first is that the reason that that Vineyard Wind wants this to go fast, and why they're concerned that this roadblock that's coming from the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is here, and it's sort of unclear when it's going to be, you know, that it's a
right.
indefinite delay,
mm-hmm.
is that Vineyard Wind is trying to break ground by the end of the year so they can be eligible for tax credits from the state.
Right.
So if they can't get this project going by the end of the year, they can't get the tax credits. And I'm sure that's a big part of the valuation of the project. But that being said, as it points out in the article I read, that Vineyard Wind really has moved along a lot faster than anyone thought it would. It's just sort of sailed through. And the Edgartown Conservation Commission saying, you know, their no vote was actually kind of a surprise. They sort of thought that would be they'd sailed through so much. And the Cape Wind did not sail through quite as easily. And of course, in the end, did not sail through at all. There's sort of some speculation that, like, well, people were like, wait, this project's moving too fast. We've got to slow down and make sure we're thinking this all the way through.
I think you're right that there is kind of a deadline because of this crazy way the production tax, this is called the PTC, the production tax credit. And it's some kind of a tax credit that the Vineyard Wind would get for generating clean electricity, right? And that always is on a kind of a two-year cycle or a short cycle. So if you don't get your project in the ground in time, then the production tax credit program dies, and then it has to be redone up, and it's always a big political flapdoodle, right? And that's the kind of risk of these wind projects.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the thing, so I don't know where this is going. I'm just sort of mentioning that it is something that we should be aware of. There may come a time we have to start pushing for an extension of the, certainly if it's a state production tax credit, we have much more leverage to make sure that that is extended in order for Vineyard Wind to be able to get in the water, right? I mean, that's however this works out, but this all of a sudden sounds like something we ought to be tracking.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not an unfamiliar territory, right? Because the SRECs and SREC 2 programs, they had, you know, it's different, obviously. Those are for solar,
mm-hmm,
and it's
mm-hmm.
The state incentive programs for solar projects, but the timeline for those was often bumped out so that more projects can be encompassed. And so maybe that is a really helpful solution. And I don't know if there's anything we can do to put pressure to ask for that timeline to be bumped out just to help the Vineyard Wind project, because it's such a big project.
Well, and the thing we got to keep in mind is that the Vineyard Wind, I think, comes under the heading of the 1,800 gigawatts of power that was mandated by the State House a couple of years ago, and in fact now they're looking to double that again. The Baker administration has doubled the mandate that says there will be this much wind turbine power in the water by a certain date. And so the Baker administration has, if Vineyard Wind is getting into trouble, the Baker administration has to go to bat for it and make sure it gets in the water, or else its own commitments will be missed.
Do you know how much, do you have any sense of how much the Baker administration actually can do if it's a federal roadblock?
Well, I think that our governor was able to find an airplane to fly down in Washington and testify about what a great climate guy he was. I mean, he can get on the same airplane and go down there and talk to people again, right, and say that we need some action here, right? I'll fly with him if he wants. I'll explain to him how it goes, at least my understanding.
That would be nice.
And that would be fun.
Yeah.
So there's that's marching ahead. We'll keep an eye on that. Tell me, Mariah, what's hot on the carbon tax front?
Yeah, I mean, in good news and in, well, not good news. It's not any news really yet, but in hopeful news that maybe this will start also to be pushing through some things like this Vineyard Wind project, is there's a bill that has been designed to to increase the state's reliance on renewable energy through a carbon tax, and it is gaining steam, quote unquote, at the Massachusetts State House. So it sounds like it's a it's a fee based on each ton of carbon dioxide emissions produced by fossil fuels that starts at $20 per ton and increases $5 a year until it reaches $40 a ton. The money goes to the Massachusetts Department of Revenue, and then they have an interesting approach. And of course, this is where all the debate comes when you're talking about these carbon fees. What do you do with the money that you get from these fees?
Right.
And there is a lot of people may support a fee, but then they may not support a certain pathway of handling that money.
Right.
But under this bill, 30% would go to a green infrastructure fund to help state agencies and cities pay for transportation resiliency and renewable energy projects that are all aimed at reducing carbon pollution. And then 70% would go to households and businesses to offset most of the increased fuel costs. And so most people who are enthusiastic about the bill says that low to middle income households will come out ahead.
Okay.
So they'll get more back in rebates than they pay in any cost increases. And people who, you know, less populated communities where people drive more would get higher rebates as well. So
they try and tune the rebates to the you know, what people are paying currently, right, to make it a little bit more equitable.
It sounds like, yeah. So it sounds like it's kind of thinking about the eco-justice piece, which is really important.
Right.
And but yet also putting money into continual infrastructure improvements, which create jobs and, you know, of course, help divert that money that we'll have to pay if we don't address resiliency and possible business impacts or in-house, you know, neighborhood impacts from rising seas and so on and so forth. But there's the critics say that it'll increase the annual tax bill for Massachusetts households, and they say it'll cost the state thousands of jobs, although most estimations say that generally that those kinds of infrastructure improvements end up creating jobs.
Does the article mention why there's momentum suddenly, and why there's cause for hope, or is it just that there's not just, but that there's hearings and there's people, the legislative process is grinding forward, right? And these bills are now under consideration.
It sounds like there's just maybe a couple of strong backers that are able to sort of promote it, including the Climate Exchange, which our friend Tim Cronin is part of. And also that there was a 2014 report prepared for the State Department of Energy that estimated a carbon fee or tax could lead to 4,000 to 10,000 more jobs by 2030. And so I think that there's just sort of more, I mean, I can't say for sure. It doesn't really touch on this, but it seems to me that there's just more numbers that make financial sense that have kind of come into play. And of course, we have Baker also talking about some initiatives for real estate and different things like that. So it's just that we're getting more comfortable with that a carbon fee is something we need.
Saying, man, that maybe that's progress. More comfortable saying the word carbon fee. Say it slowly. All right, Mariah, we should put it down there. Thank you very much for that. What we'll do is we'll put up links to most of what we talked about on the blog. It's at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find this show on our Facebook page, plus a lot of other good stuff at mass/massclimateaction. You can send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. I like that. podcast@massclimateaction.net. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using all those fancy modern things called apps. I don't know what they are. I want to thank D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. And I want to say that we'll close in closing that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our collective future. So, Mariah, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.